made the emergence of a broad coalition opposed to absolutism possible, and thus laid the foundations for pluralistic political institutions. Though contested, the political and economic institutions the Tudors inherited and sustained were clearly extractive. In 1603, Elizabeth I, Henry VIII's daughter, who had acceded to the throne of England in 1553, died without children, and the Tudors were replaced by the Stuart dynasty. The first Stuart king, James I, inherited not only the institutions but the conflicts over them. He desired to be an absolutist ruler. Though the state had become more centralized and social change was redistributing power in society, political institutions were not yet pluralistic. In the economy, extractive institutions manifested themselves not just in the opposition to Lee's invention, but in the form of monopolies, and more monopolies. In 1601, a list of these was read out in Parliament, with one member ironically asking, "Is not bread there?" By 1621, there were 700 of them. As the English historian Christopher Hill put it, a man lived in a house built with monopoly bricks, with windows of monopoly glass, heated by monopoly coal, in Ireland monopoly timber, burning in a grate made of monopoly iron. He washed himself in monopoly soap, his clothes in monopoly starch. He dressed in monopoly lace, monopoly linen, monopoly leather, monopoly gold thread. His clothes were held up by monopoly belts, monopoly buttons, monopoly pins. They were dyed with monopoly dyes. He ate monopoly butter, monopoly currants, monopoly red herrings, monopoly salmon, and monopoly lobsters. His food was seasoned with monopoly salt, monopoly pepper, monopoly vinegar. He wrote with monopoly pens on monopoly writing paper, read through monopoly spectacles by the light of monopoly candles, monopoly printed books. These monopolies, and many more, gave individuals or groups the sole right to control the production of many goods. They impeded the type of allocation of talent, which is so crucial to economic prosperity. Both James I and his son and successor Charles I aspired to strengthen the monarchy, reduce the influence of Parliament, and establish absolutist institutions similar to those being constructed in Spain and France to further their and the elite's control of the economy, making institutions more extractive. The conflict between James I and Parliament came to a head in the 1620s. Central in this conflict was the control of trade both overseas and within the British Isles. The Crown's ability to grant monopolies was a key source of revenue for the state, and was used frequently as a way of granting exclusive rights to supporters of the king. Not surprisingly, this extractive institution, blocking entry and inhibiting the functioning of the market, was also highly damaging to economic activity and to the interest of many members of Parliament. In 1623, Parliament scored a notable victory by managing to pass the Statute of Monopolies, which prohibited James I from creating new domestic monopolies. He would still be able to grant monopolies on international trade, however, since the authority of Parliament did not extend to international affairs. Existing monopolies, international or otherwise, stood untouched. Parliament did not sit regularly and had to be called into session by the king. The convention that emerged after the Magna Carta was that the king was required to convene Parliament to get assent for new taxes. Charles I came to the throne in 1625, declined to call Parliament after 1629, and intensified James I's efforts to build a more solidly absolutist regime. He induced forced loans, meaning that people had to lend him money, and he unilaterally changed the terms of loans and refused to repay his debts. He created and sold monopolies in the one dimension that the Statute of Monopolies had left to him, overseas trading ventures. He also undermined the independence of the judiciary and attempted to intervene to influence the outcome of legal cases. He levied many fines and charges, the most contentious of which was ship money. In 1634, taxing the coastal counties to pay for the support of the Royal Navy, and in 1635, extending the levy to the inland counties. Ship money was levied each year until 1640. Charles' increasingly absolutist behavior and extractive policies created resentment and resistance throughout the country. In 1640, he faced conflict with Scotland, and without enough money to put a proper army into the field, was forced to call Parliament to ask for more taxes. The so-called Short Parliament sat for only 3 weeks. The parliamentarians who came to London refused to talk about taxes, but aired many grievances, until Charles dismissed them. The Scots realized that Charles did not have the support of the nation and invaded England, occupying the city of Newcastle. Charles opened negotiations, and the Scots demanded that Parliament be involved. This induced Charles to call what then became known as the Long Parliament, because it continued to sit until 1648, refusing to dissolve even when Charles demanded it do so. In 1642, the Civil War broke out between Charles and Parliament, even though there were many in Parliament who sided with the Crown. The pattern of conflicts reflected the struggle over economic and political institutions. Parliament wanted an end to absolutist political institutions. The king wanted them strengthened. These conflicts were rooted in economics. Many supported the crown because they had been granted lucrative monopolies. For example, the local monopolies controlled by the rich and powerful merchants of Shrewsbury and Oswestry were protected by the crown from competition by London merchants. These merchants sided with Charles I. On the other side, the metallurgical industry had flourished around Birmingham because monopolies were weak there and newcomers to the industry did not have to serve a 7-year apprenticeship as they did in other parts of the country. During the Civil War, they made swords and produced volunteers for the parliamentary side. Similarly, the lack of guild regulation in the county of Lancashire allowed for the development before 1640 of the new draperies, a new style of lighter cloth. The area where the production of these cloths was concentrated was the only part of Lancashire to support Parliament. Under the leadership of Oliver Cromwell, the parliamentarians, known as the Roundheads after the style in which their hair was cropped, defeated the Royalists, known as Cavaliers. Charles was tried and executed in 1649. His defeat and the abolition of the monarchy did not, however, result in inclusive institutions. Instead, monarchy was replaced by the dictatorship of Oliver Cromwell. Following Cromwell's death, the monarchy was restored in 1660 and clawed back many of the privileges that had been stripped from it in 1649. Charles's son, Charles II, then set about the same program of creating absolutism in England. These attempts were only intensified by his brother James II, who ascended to the throne after Charles' death in 1685. In 1688, James's attempt to re-establish absolutism created another crisis and another civil war. Parliament this time was more united and organized. They invited the Dutch stadtholder, William of Orange, and his wife Mary, James's Protestant daughter, to replace James. William would bring an army and claim the throne, to rule not as an absolutist monarch, but under a constitutional monarchy forged by Parliament. 2 months after William's landing in the British Isles at Brixham in Devon, see map 9, James's army disintegrated, and he fled to France. The Glorious Revolution. After victory in the Glorious Revolution, Parliament and William negotiated a new constitution. The changes were foreshadowed by William's declaration, made shortly prior to his invasion. They were further enshrined in the Declaration of Rights, produced by Parliament in February 1689. The declaration was read out to William at the same session where he was offered the crown. In many ways, the declaration, which would be called the Bill of Rights after its signing into law, was vague. Crucially, however, it did establish some central constitutional principles. It determined the succession to the throne, and did so in a way that departed significantly from the then-received hereditary principles. If Parliament could remove a monarch and replace him with one more to their liking once, then why not again? The Declaration of Rights also asserted that the monarch could not suspend or dispense with laws, and it reiterated the illegality of taxation without parliamentary consent. In addition, it stated that there could be no standing army in England without parliamentary consent. Vagueness entered into such clauses as number 8, which stated, "The election of members of Parliament ought to be free," but did not specify how free was to be determined. Even vaguer was Clause 13, whose main point was that parliaments ought to be held frequently. Since when and whether parliament would be held had been such a contentious issue for the entire century, one might have expected much more specificity in this clause. Nevertheless, the reason for this vague wording is clear. Clauses have to be enforced. During the reign of Charles II, a triennial act had been in place that asserted that parliaments had to be called at least once every 3 years. But Charles ignored it, and nothing happened because there was no method of enforcing it. After 1688, Parliament could have tried to introduce a method for enforcing this clause, as the barons had done with their council after King John signed the Magna Carta. They did not do so because they did not need to. This was because authority and decision-making power switched to Parliament after 1688. Even without specific constitutional rules or laws, William simply gave up on many of the practices of previous kings. He stopped interfering in legal decisions and gave up previous rights, such as getting the customs revenues for life. Taken together, these changes in political institutions represented the triumph of Parliament over the king, and thus the end of absolutism in England, and subsequently Great Britain, as England and Scotland were united by the Act of Union in 1707. From then on, Parliament was firmly in control of state policy. This made a huge difference, because the interests of Parliament were very different from those of the Stuart kings. Since many of those in Parliament had important investments in trade and industry, they had a strong stake in enforcing property rights. The Stuarts had frequently infringed on property rights. Now they would be upheld. Moreover, when the Stuarts controlled how the government spent money, Parliament opposed greater taxes and balked at strengthening the power of the state. Now that Parliament itself controlled spending, it was happy to raise taxes and spend the money on activities that it deemed valuable. Chief among them was the strengthening of the navy, which would protect the overseas mercantile interests of many of the members of Parliament. Even more important than the interest of parliamentarians was the emerging pluralistic nature of political institutions. The English people now had access to Parliament and the policy and economic institutions made in Parliament, in a way they never had when policy was driven by the king. This was partially, of course, because members of Parliament were elected. But since England was far from being a democracy in this period, this access provided only a modest amount of responsiveness. Among its many inequities was that less than 2% of the population could vote in the 18th century, and these had to be men. The cities where the Industrial Revolution took place, Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester and Sheffield, had no independent representation in Parliament. Instead, rural areas were overrepresented. Just as bad, the right to vote in the rural areas, the counties, was based on ownership of land, and many urban areas, the boroughs, were controlled by a small elite who did not allow the new industrialists to vote or run for office. In the borough of Buckingham, for instance, 13 burgesses had the exclusive right to vote. On top of this, there were the rotten boroughs, which had historically had the right to vote but had rotted away, either because their population had moved over time, or in the case on Dunwich on the east coast of England, had actually fallen into the ocean as a result of coastal erosion. In each of these rotten boroughs, a small number of voters elected 2 members of Parliament. Old Sarum had 7 voters, Dunwich 32, and each elected 2 members of Parliament. But there were other ways to influence Parliament, and thus economic institutions. The most important was via petitioning, and this was much more significant than the limited extent of democracy for the emergence of pluralism after the Glorious Revolution. Anybody could petition Parliament, and petition they did. Significantly, when people petitioned, Parliament listened. It is this more than anything that reflects the defeat of absolutism, the empowerment of a fairly broad segment of society, and the rise of pluralism in England after 1688. The frantic petitioning activity shows that it was indeed such a broad group in society, far beyond those sitting or even being represented in Parliament, that had the power to influence the way the state worked, and they used it. The case of monopolies best illustrates this. We have seen how monopolies were at the heart of extractive economic institutions in the 17th century. They came under attack in 1623 with the Statute of Monopolies, and were a serious bone of contention during the English Civil War. The Long Parliament abolished all the domestic monopolies that so impinged on people's lives. Though Charles II and James II could not bring these back, they managed to maintain the ability to grant overseas monopolies. One was the Royal African Company, whose monopoly charter was issued by Charles II in 1660. This company held a monopoly on the lucrative African slave trade, and its governor and major shareholder was Charles's brother James, soon to become James II. After 1688, the company lost not just its governor, but its main supporter. James had assiduously protected the monopoly of the company against interlopers, the independent traders who tried to buy slaves in West Africa and sell them in the Americas. This was a very profitable trade, and the Royal African Company faced a lot of challenges, since all other English trade in the Atlantic was free. In 1689, the company seized the cargo of an interloper, one Nightingale. Nightingale sued the company for illegal seizure of goods, and Chief Justice Holt ruled that the company's seizure was unlawful because it was exercising a monopoly right created by royal prerogative. Holt reasoned that monopoly privileges could be created only by statute, and this had to be done by Parliament. So Holt pushed all future monopolies, not just of the Royal Africa Company, into the hands of Parliament. Before 1688, James II would quickly have removed any judge who made such a ruling. After 1688, things were different. Parliament now had to decide what to do with the monopoly, and the petitions began to fly. 135 came from interlopers demanding free access to trade in the Atlantic. Though the Royal African Company responded in kind, it could not hope to match the number or scope of the petitions demanding its demise. The interlopers succeeded in framing their opposition in terms not just of narrow self-interest, but of national interest, which indeed it was. As a result, only 5 of the 135 petitions were signed by the interlopers themselves, and 73 of the interlopers' petitions came from the provinces outside London, as against 8 for the company. From the colonies, where petitioning was also allowed, the interlopers gathered 27 petitions, the company 11. The interlopers also gathered far more signatures for their petitions, in total 8,000, as opposed to 2,500 for the company. The struggle continued until 1698, when the Royal African Company monopoly was abolished. Along with this new locus for the determination of economic institutions and the new responsiveness after 1688, parliamentarians started making a series of key changes in economic institutions and government policy that would ultimately pave the way for the Industrial Revolution. Property rights eroded under the Stuarts were strengthened. Parliament began a process of reform in economic institutions to promote manufacturing rather than taxing and impeding it. The hearth tax, an annual tax for each fireplace or stove, which fell most heavily on manufacturers, who were bitterly opposed to it, was abolished in 1689, soon after William and Mary ascended the throne. Instead of taxing hearths, Parliament moved to start taxing land. Redistributing the tax burden was not the only pro-manufacturing policy that Parliament supported. A whole series of acts and legislations that would expand the market and the profitability of woolen textiles was passed. This all made political sense, since many of the parliamentarians who opposed James were heavily invested in these nascent manufacturing enterprises. Parliament also passed legislation that allowed for a complete reorganization of property rights in land, permitting the consolidation and elimination of many archaic forms of property and user rights. Another priority of Parliament was reforming finance. Though there had been an expansion of banking and finance in the period leading up to the Glorious Revolution, this process was further cemented by the creation of the Bank of England in 1694 as a source of funds for industry. It was another direct consequence of the Glorious Revolution. The foundation of the Bank of England paved the way for a much more extensive financial revolution, which led to a great expansion of financial markets and banking. By the early 18th century, loans would be available to everyone who could put up the necessary collateral. The records of a relatively small bank, C. Hoare's and Company in London, which have survived intact from the period 1702 to 1724, illustrate this point. Though the bank did lend money to aristocrats and lords, fully two-thirds of the biggest borrowers from whores over this period were not from the privileged social classes. Instead, they were merchants and businessmen, including one John Smith, a man with the name of the eponymous average Englishman, who was loaned £2,600 by the bank during the period 1715 to 1719. So far, we have emphasized how the Glorious Revolution transformed English political institutions, making them more pluralistic, and also started laying the foundations for inclusive economic institutions. There is one more significant change in institutions that emerged from the Glorious Revolution. Parliament continued the process of political centralization that was initiated by the Tudors. It was not just that constraints increased, or that the state regulated the economy in a different way, or that the English state spent money on different things, but also the capability and capacity of the state increased in all directions. This again illustrates the linkages between political centralization and pluralism. Parliament had opposed making the state more effective and better resourced prior to 1688 because it could not control it. After 1688, it was a different story. The state started expanding, with expenditures soon reaching around 10% of national income. This was underpinned by an expansion of the tax base, particularly with respect to the excise tax, which was levied on the production of a long list of domestically produced commodities. This was a very large state budget for the period, and is in fact larger than what we see today in many parts of the world. The state budgets in Colombia, for example, reached this relative size only in the 1980s. In many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, in Sierra Leone, the state budget even today would be far smaller relative to the size of the economy without the large inflows of foreign aid. But the expansion of the size of the state is only part of the process of political centralization. More important than this was the qualitative way the state functioned, and the way those who controlled it and those who worked in it behaved. The construction of state institutions in England reached back into the Middle Ages, but as we've seen, steps toward political centralization and the development of modern administration were decisively taken by Henry VII and Henry VIII. Yet the state was still far from the modern form that would emerge after 1688. For example, many appointees were made on political grounds, not because of merit or talent, and the state still had a very limited capacity to raise taxes. After 1688, Parliament began to improve the ability to raise revenue through taxation, a development well illustrated by the excise tax bureaucracy, which expanded rapidly from 1,211 people in 1690 to 4,800 by 1780. Excise tax inspectors were stationed throughout the country, supervised by collectors who engaged in tours of inspection to measure and check the amount of bread, beer, and other goods subject to the excise tax. The extent of this operation is illustrated by the reconstruction of the excise rounds of Supervisor George Cowperthwaite by the historian John Brewer. Between June 12th and July 5th, 1710, Supervisor Cowperthwaite traveled 290 miles in the Richmond district of Yorkshire. During this period, he visited 263 victuallers, 71 maltsters, 20 chandlers, and one common brewer. In all, he took 81 different measurements of production and checked the work of 9 different excisemen who worked for him. 8 years later, we find him working just as hard, but now in the Wakefield district, in a different part of Yorkshire. In Wakefield, he traveled more than 19 miles a day on average and worked 6 days a week, normally inspecting 4 or 5 premises. On his day off, Sunday, he made up his books, so we have a complete record of his activities. Indeed, the excise tax system had very elaborate record-keeping. Officers kept 3 different types of records, all of which were supposed to match one another, and any tampering with these records was a serious offense. This remarkable level of state supervision of society exceeds what the governments of most poor countries can achieve today, and this in 1710. Also significantly, after 1688, the state began to rely more on talent and less on political appointees, and developed a powerful infrastructure to run the country. The Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution was manifested in every aspect of the English economy. There were major improvements in transportation, metallurgy, and steam power. But the most significant area of innovation was the mechanization of textile production and the development of factories to produce these manufactured textiles. This dynamic process was unleashed by the institutional changes that flowed from the Glorious Revolution. This was not just about the abolition of domestic monopolies, which had been achieved by 1640, or about different taxes or access to finance. It was about a fundamental reorganization of economic institutions in favor of innovators and entrepreneurs, based on the emergence of more secure and efficient property rights. Improvements in the security and efficiency of property rights, for example, played a central role in the transportation revolution, paving the way for the Industrial Revolution. Investments in canals and roads, the so-called turnpikes, massively increased after 1688. These investments, by reducing the costs of transportation, helped to create an important prerequisite for the Industrial Revolution. Prior to 1688, investment in such infrastructure had been impeded by arbitrary acts by the Stuart kings. The change in the situation after 1688 is vividly illustrated by the case of the River Salwarp in Worcestershire, England. In 1662, Parliament passed an act to encourage investment to make the Salwarp navigable, and the Baldwin family invested £6,000 to this end. In return, they got the right to charge people for navigation on the river. In 1693, a bill was introduced to Parliament to transfer the rights to charge for navigation to the Earl of Shrewsbury and Lord Coventry. This act was challenged by Sir Timothy Baldwin, who immediately submitted a petition to Parliament claiming that the proposed bill was essentially expropriating his father, who had already heavily invested in the river in anticipation of the charges he could then levy. Baldwin argued that the new act tends to make void the said act and to take away all the works and materials done in pursuance thereof. Reallocation of rights such as this was exactly the sort of thing done by Stuart monarchs, Baldwin noted. It is of dangerous consequence to take away any person's right purchased under an act of Parliament without their consent. In the event, the new act failed, and Baldwin's rights were upheld. Property rights were much more secure after 1688, partly because securing them was consistent with the interests of Parliament, and partly because pluralistic institutions could be influenced by petitioning. We see here that after 1688, the political system became significantly more pluralistic and created a relatively level playing field within England. Underlying the transportation revolution, and more generally the reorganization of land that took place in the 18th century, were parliamentary acts that changed the nature of property ownership. Until 1688, there was even the legal fiction that all the land in England was ultimately owned by the crown, a direct legacy from the feudal organization of society. Any piece of land was encumbered by numerous archaic forms of property rights and many cross-cutting claims. Much land was held in so-called equitable estates, which meant that the landowner could not mortgage, lease, or sell the land. Common land could often be used only for traditional uses. There were enormous impediments to using land in ways that would be economically desirable. Parliament began to change this, allowing groups of people to petition Parliament to simplify and reorganize property rights, alterations that were subsequently embodied into hundreds of acts of Parliament. This reorganization of economic institutions also manifested itself in the emergence of an agenda to protect domestic textile production against foreign imports. Not surprisingly, parliamentarians and their constituents were not opposed to all entry barriers and monopolies. Those that would increase their own market and profits would be welcome. However, crucially, the pluralistic political institutions, the fact that Parliament represented, empowered, and listened to a broad segment of society, meant that these entry barriers would not choke other industrialists or completely shut out newcomers, as the Serrata did in Venice. the powerful woolen manufacturers soon made this discovery. In 1688, some of the most significant imports into England were textiles from India, calicoes and muslins, which comprised about one quarter of all textile imports. Also important were silks from China. Calicoes and silks were imported by the East India Company, which prior to 1688 enjoyed a government-sanctioned monopoly over the trade with Asia. But the monopoly and the political power of the East India Company was sustained through heavy bribes to James II. After 1688, the company was in a vulnerable position and soon under attack. This took the form of an intense war of petitions with traders hoping to trade in the Far East and India, demanding that Parliament sanction competition for the East India Company, while the company responded with counterpetitions and offers to lend Parliament money. The company lost, and a new East India Company to compete with it was founded. But textile producers did not just want more competition in the trade to India. They wanted imports of cheap Indian textiles, calicoes, taxed, or even banned. These producers faced strong competition from these cheap Indian imports. At this point, the most important domestic manufacturers produced woolen textiles, but the producers of cotton cloths were becoming both more important economically and more powerful politically. The wool industry mounted attempts to protect itself as early as the 1660s. It promoted the sumptuary laws, which, among other things, prohibited the wearing of lighter cloth. It also lobbied Parliament to pass legislation in 1666 and 1678 that would make it illegal for someone to be buried in anything other than a woolen shroud. Both measures protected the market for woolen goods and reduced the competition that English manufacturers faced from Asia. Nevertheless, in this period, the East India Company was too strong to restrict imports of Asian textiles. The tide changed after 1688. Between 1696 and 1698, woolen manufacturers from East Anglia and the West Country allied with silk weavers from London, Canterbury, and the Levant Company to restrict imports. The silk importers from the Levant, even if they had recently lost their monopoly, wished to exclude Asian silks to create a niche for silks from the Ottoman Empire. This coalition started to present bills to Parliament to place restrictions on the wearing of Asian cottons and silks, and also restrictions on the dyeing and printing of textiles in England. In response, in 1701, Parliament finally passed an Act for the More Effectual Employing the Poor by encouraging the manufacturers of this kingdom. From September 1701, it decreed, "All wrought silks, bengals, and stuffs mixed with silk of Urba, of the manufacture of Persia, China, or East India, all calicoes painted, dyed, printed, or stained there, which are or shall be imported into this kingdom, shall not be worn." It was now illegal to wear Asian silks and calicoes in England, but it was still possible to import them for re-export to Europe or elsewhere, in particular to the American colonies. Moreover, plain calicoes could be imported and finished in England, and muslins were exempt from the ban. After a long struggle, these loopholes, as the domestic woolen textile manufacturers viewed them, were closed by the Calico Act of 1721. After December 25, 1722, it shall not be lawful for any person or persons whatsoever to use or wear in Great Britain, in any garment or apparel whatsoever, any printed, painted, stained, or dyed calico. Though this act removed competition from Asia for English woolens, it still left an active domestic cotton and linen industry competing against the woolens. Cotton and linen were mixed to produce a popular cloth called fustian. Having excluded Asian competition, the wool industry now turned to clamp down on linen. Linen was primarily made in Scotland and Ireland, which gave some scope to an English coalition to demand those countries' exclusion from English markets. However, there were limits to the power of the woolen manufacturers. Their new attempts encountered strong opposition from fustian producers in the burgeoning industrial centers of Manchester, Lancaster, and Liverpool. The pluralistic political institutions implied that all these different groups now had access to the policy process in Parliament via voting and, more important, petitioning. Though the petitions flew from the pens of both sides, amassing signatures for and against, the outcome of this conflict was a victory for the new interests against those of the wool industry. The Manchester Act of 1736 agreed that great quantities of stuffs made from linen yarn and cotton wool have for several years past been manufactured and have been printed and painted within this kingdom of Great Britain. It then went on to assert that nothing in the said recited Act of 1721 shall extend or be construed to prohibit the wearing or using in apparel, household stuff, furniture, or otherwise, any sort of stuff made out of linen yarn and cotton wool, manufactured and printed or painted with any color or colors within the Kingdom of Great Britain. The Manchester Act was a significant victory for the nascent cotton manufacturers, but its historical and economic significance was in fact much greater. First, it demonstrated the limits of entry barriers that the pluralistic political institutions of parliamentary England would permit. Second, over the next half century, technological innovations in the manufacture of cotton cloth would play a central role in the Industrial Revolution and fundamentally transform society by introducing the factory system. After 1688, though domestically a level playing field emerged, internationally, Parliament strove to tilt it. This was evident not only from the Calico Acts, but also from the Navigation Acts, the first of which was passed in 1651, and they remained in force with alterations for the next 200 years. The aim of these acts was to facilitate England's monopolization of international trade, though crucially this was monopolization not by the state, but by the private sector. The basic principle was that English trade should be carried in English ships. The acts made it illegal for foreign ships to transport goods from outside Europe to England or its colonies, and it was similarly illegal for third-party country ships to ship goods from a country elsewhere in Europe to England. This advantage for English traders and manufacturers naturally increased their profits and may have further encouraged innovation in these new and highly profitable activities. By 1760, the combination of all these factors, improved and new property rights, improved infrastructure, a changed fiscal regime, greater access to finance, and aggressive protection of traders and manufacturers abroad, was beginning to have an effect. After this date, there was a jump in the number of patented inventions, and the great flowering of technological change that was to be at the heart of the Industrial Revolution began to be evident. Innovations took place on many fronts, reflecting the improved institutional environment. One crucial area was power, most famously the transformations in the use of the steam engine that were a result of James Watt's ideas in the 1760s. Watt's initial breakthrough was to introduce a separate condensing chamber for the steam so that the cylinder that housed the piston could be kept continually hot instead of having to be warmed up and cooled down. He subsequently developed many other ideas, including much more efficient methods of converting the motion of the steam engine into useful power, notably his sun and planets gear system. In all these areas, technological innovations built on earlier work by others. In the context of the steam engine, this included early work by English inventor Thomas Newcomen, and also by Dionysius Papin, a French physicist and inventor. The story of Papin's invention is another example of how, under extractive institutions, the threat of creative destruction impeded technological change. Papin developed a design for a steam digester in 1679, and in 1690 he extended this into a piston engine. In 1705, he used this rudimentary engine to build the world's first steamboat. Papin was by this time a professor of mathematics at the University of Marburg in the German state of Kassel. He decided to steam the boat down the river Fulda to the river Weser. Any boat making this trip was forced to stop at the city of Münden. At that time, river traffic on the Fulda and Weser was the monopoly of a guild of boatmen. Papin must have sensed that there might be trouble. His friend and mentor, the famous German physicist Gottfried Leibniz, wrote to the Elector of Kassel, the head of state, petitioning that Papin should be allowed to pass unmolested through Kassel. Yet Leibniz's petition was rebuffed and he received the curt answer that the electoral counselors have found serious obstacles in the way of granting the above petition, and, without giving their reasons, have directed me to inform you of their decision, and that in consequence the request is not granted by His Electoral Highness. Undeterred, Papin decided to make the journey anyway. When his steamer arrived at Münden, the Boatman's Guild first tried to get a local judge to impound the ship, but was unsuccessful. The boatman then set upon Papin's boat and smashed it and the steam engine to pieces. Papin died a pauper and was buried in an unmarked grave. In Tudor or Stuart England, Papin might have received similar hostile treatment. But this all changed after 1688. Indeed, Papin was intending to sail his boat to London before it was destroyed. In metallurgy, key contributions were made in the 1780s by Henry Cort, who introduced new techniques for dealing with impurities in iron, allowing for a much better quality wrought iron to be produced. This was critical for the manufacture of machine parts, nails, and tools. The production of vast quantities of wrought iron using Cort's techniques was facilitated by the innovations of Abraham Darby and his sons, who pioneered the use of coal to smelt iron beginning in 1709. This process was enhanced in 1762 by the adaptation by John Smeaton of water power to operate blowing cylinders and making coke. After this, charcoal vanished from the production of iron, to be replaced by coal, which was much cheaper and more readily available. Even though innovation is obviously cumulative, there was a distinct acceleration in the middle of the 18th century. In no place was this more visible than in textile production. The most basic operation in the production of textiles is spinning, which involves taking plant or animal fibers, such as cotton or wool, and twisting them together to form yarn. This yarn is then woven to make up textiles. One of the great technological innovations of the medieval period was the spinning wheel, which replaced hand spinning. This invention appeared around 1280 in Europe, probably disseminating from the Middle East. The methods of spinning did not change until the 18th century. Significant innovations began in 1738, when Louis Paul patented a new method of spinning using rollers to replace human hands to draw out the fibers being spun. The machine did not work well, however, and it was the innovations of Richard Arkwright and James Hargreaves that truly revolutionized spinning. In 1769, Arkwright, one of the dominant figures of the Industrial Revolution, patented his water frame, which was a huge improvement over Lewis's machine. He formed a partnership with Jedediah Strutt and Samuel Need, who were hosiery manufacturers. In 1771, they built one of the world's first factories at Cromford. The new machines were powered by water, but Arkwright later made the crucial transition to steam power. By 1774, his firm employed 600 workers, and he expanded aggressively, eventually setting up factories in Manchester, Matlock, Bath, and New Lanark in Scotland. Arkwright's innovations were complemented by Hargreaves' invention in 1764 of the spinning jenny, which was further developed by Samuel Crompton in 1779 into the mule, and later by Richard Roberts into the self-acting mule. The effects of these innovations were truly revolutionary. Earlier in the century, it took 50,000 hours for hand spinners to spin 100 pounds of cotton. Arkwright's water frame could do it in 300 hours, and the self-acting mule in 135. Along with the mechanization of spinning came the mechanization of weaving. An important first step was the invention of the flying shuttle by John Kay in 1733. Though it initially simply increased the productivity of hand weavers, its most enduring impact would be in opening the way to mechanized weaving. Building on the flying shuttle, Edmund Cartwright introduced the power loom in 1785, a first step in a series of innovations that would lead to machines replacing manual skills in weaving, as they were also doing in spinning. The English textile industry not only was the driving force behind the Industrial Revolution, but also revolutionized the world economy. English exports, led by cotton textiles, doubled between 1780 and 1800. It was the growth in this sector that pulled ahead the whole economy. The combination of technological and organizational innovation provides the model for economic progress that transformed the economies of the world that became rich. New people with new ideas were crucial to this transformation. Consider innovation in transportation. In England, there were several waves of such innovations. First canals, then roads, and finally railways. In each of these waves, the innovators were new men. Canals started to develop in England after 1770, and by 1810, they had linked up many of the most important manufacturing areas. As the Industrial Revolution unfolded, canals played an important role in reducing transportation costs for moving around the bulky new finished industrial goods, such as cotton textiles, and the inputs that went into them, particularly raw cotton and coal for the steam engines. Early innovators in building canals were men such as James Brindley, who was employed by the Duke of Bridgewater to build the Bridgewater Canal, which ended up linking the key industrial city of Manchester to the port of Liverpool. Born in rural Derbyshire, Brindley was a millwright by profession. His reputation for finding creative solutions to engineering problems came to the attention of the Duke. He had no previous experience with transportation problems, which also was true of other great canal engineers such as Thomas Telford, who started life as a stonemason, or John Smeaton, an instrument maker and engineer. Just as the great canal engineers had no previous connection to transportation, neither did the great road and railway engineers. John McAdam, who invented tarmac around 1816, was the second son of a minor aristocrat. The first steam train was built by Richard Trevithick in 1804. Trevithick's father was involved in mining in Cornwall, and Richard entered the same business at an early age, becoming fascinated by steam engines used for pumping out the mines. More significant were the innovations of George Stephenson, the son of illiterate parents and the inventor of the famous train, the Rocket, who began work as an engineman at a coal mine. New men also drove the critical cotton textile industry. Some of the pioneers of this new industry were people who had previously been heavily involved in the production and trade of woolen cloths. John Foster, for example, employed 700 handloom weavers in the woolen industry at the time he switched to cotton and opened Black Dyke Mills in 1835. But men such as Foster were a minority. Only about one-fifth of the leading industrialists at this time had previously been involved in anything like manufacturing activities. This is not surprising. For one, the cotton industry developed in new towns in the north of England. Factories were a completely new way of organizing production. The woolen industry had been organized in a very different way, by putting out materials to individuals in their homes, who spun and wove on their own. Most of those in the woolen industry were therefore ill-equipped to switch to cotton, as Foster did. Newcomers were needed to develop and use the new technologies. The rapid expansion of cotton decimated the wool industry. Creative destruction in action. Creative destruction redistributes not simply income and wealth, but also political power, as William Lee learned when he found the authorities so unreceptive to his invention because they feared its political consequences. As the industrial economy expanded in Manchester and Birmingham, the new factory owners and middle-class groups that emerged around them began to protest their disenfranchisement and the government policies opposed to their interests. Their prime candidate was the Corn Laws, which banned the import of corn, all grains and cereals, but principally wheat, if the price got too low, thus ensuring that the profits of large landowners were kept high. This policy was very good for big landowners who produced wheat, but bad for manufacturers, because they had to pay higher wages to compensate for the high price of bread. With workers concentrated into new factories and industrial centers, it became easier to organize and riot. By the 1820s, the political exclusion of the new manufacturers and manufacturing centers was becoming untenable. On August 16, 1819, a meeting to protest the political system and the policies of the government was planned to be held in St. Peter's Fields, Manchester. The organizer was Joseph Johnson, a local brush manufacturer, and one of the founders of the radical newspaper, the Manchester Observer. Other organizers included John Knight, a cotton manufacturer and reformer, and John Thacker Saxton, editor of the Manchester Observer. 60,000 protesters gathered, many holding banners such as No Corn Laws, Universal Suffrage, and Vote by Ballot, meaning voting should take place secretly, not openly, as it did in 1819. The authorities were very nervous about the meeting, and a force of 600 cavalry of the 15th Hussars had been assembled. As the speeches began, a local magistrate decided to issue a warrant for the arrest of the speakers. As police tried to enforce the warrant, they met with the opposition of the crowd, and fighting broke out. At this point, the Hussars charged the crowd. Within a few chaotic minutes, 11 people were dead, and probably 600 wounded. The Manchester Observer called it the Peterloo Massacre. But given the changes that had already taken place in economic and political institutions, long-run repression was not a solution in England. The Peterloo Massacre would remain an isolated incident. Following the riot, the political institutions in England gave way to the pressure, and the destabilizing threat of much wider social unrest, particularly after the 1830 revolution in France against Charles X, who had tried to restore the absolutism destroyed by the French Revolution of 1789. In 1832, the government passed the first Reform Act. It enfranchised Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester, and Sheffield, and broadened the base of voting so that manufacturers could be represented in Parliament. The consequent shift in political power moved policy in the direction favored by these newly represented interests. In 1846, they managed to get the hated Corn Laws repealed, demonstrating again that creative destruction meant a redistribution, not just of income, but also of political power. And naturally, changes in the distribution of political power, in time, would lead to a further redistribution of income. It was the inclusive nature of English institutions that allowed this process to take place. Those who suffered from and feared creative destruction were no longer able to stop it. Why in England? The Industrial Revolution started and made its biggest strides in England because of her uniquely inclusive economic institutions. These, in turn, were built on foundations laid by the inclusive political institutions brought about by the Glorious Revolution. It was the Glorious Revolution that strengthened and rationalized property rights, improved financial markets, undermined state-sanctioned monopolies in foreign trade, and removed the barriers to the expansion of industry. It was the Glorious Revolution that made the political system open and responsive to the economic needs and aspirations of society. These inclusive economic institutions gave men of talent and vision, such as James Watt, the opportunity and incentive to develop their skills and ideas and influence the system in ways that benefited them and the nation. Naturally, these men, once they had become successful, had the same urges as any other person. They wanted to block others from entering their businesses and competing against them, and feared the process of creative destruction that might put them out of business, as they had previously bankrupted others. But after 1688, this became harder to accomplish. In 1775, Richard Arkwright took out an encompassing patent that he hoped would give him a monopoly on the rapidly expanding cotton spinning industry in the future. He could not get the courts to enforce it. Why did this unique process start in England, and why in the 17th century? Why did England develop pluralistic political institutions and break away from extractive institutions? As we have seen, the political developments leading up to the Glorious Revolution were shaped by several interlinked processes. Central was the political conflict between absolutism and its opponents. The outcome of this conflict not only put a stop to the attempts to create a renewed and stronger absolutism in England, but also empowered those wishing to fundamentally change the institutions of society. The opponents of absolutism did not simply attempt to build a different type of absolutism. This was not simply the House of Lancaster defeating the House of York in the War of the Roses. Instead, the Glorious Revolution involved the emergence of a new regime based on constitutional rule and pluralism. This outcome was a consequence of the drift in English institutions and the way they interacted with critical junctures. We saw in the previous chapter how feudal institutions were created in Western Europe after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. Feudalism spread throughout most of Europe, West and East. But as Chapter 4 showed, Western and Eastern Europe began to diverge radically after the Black Death. Small differences in political and economic institutions meant that in the West, the balance of power led to institutional improvement. In the East, to institutional deterioration. But this was not a path that would necessarily and inexorably lead to inclusive institutions. Many more crucial turns would have to be taken on the way. Though the Magna Carta had attempted to establish some basic institutional foundations for constitutional rule, many other parts of Europe, even Eastern Europe, saw similar struggles with similar documents. Yet after the Black Death, Western Europe significantly drifted away from the East. Documents, such as the Magna Carta, started to have more bite in the West. In the East, they came to mean little. In England, even before the conflicts of the 17th century, the norm was established that the king could not raise new taxes without the consent of Parliament. No less important was the slow, incremental drift of power away from elites to citizens more generally, as exemplified by the political mobilization of rural communities, seen in England with such moments as the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. This drift of institutions now interacted with another critical juncture, caused by the massive expansion of trade into the Atlantic. As we saw in Chapter 4, one crucial way in which this influenced future institutional dynamics depended on whether or not the Crown was able to monopolize this trade. In England, the somewhat greater power of Parliament meant that the Tudor and Stuart monarchs could not do so. This created a new class of merchants and businessmen, who aggressively opposed the plan to create absolutism in England. By 1686, in London, for example, there were 702 merchants exporting to the Caribbean and 1,283 importing. North America had 691 exporting and 626 importing merchants. They employed warehousemen, sailors, captains, dock workers, clerks, all of whom broadly shared their interests. Other vibrant ports, such as Bristol, Liverpool, and Portsmouth, were similarly full of such merchants. These new men wanted and demanded different economic institutions, and as they got wealthier through trade, they became more powerful. The same forces were at work in France, Spain, and Portugal. But there, the kings were much more able to control trade and its profits. The type of new group that was to transform England did emerge in those countries, but was considerably smaller and weaker. When the Long Parliament sat and the Civil War broke out in 1642, these merchants primarily sided with the parliamentary cause. In the 1670s, they were heavily involved in the formation of the Whig Party to oppose Stuart absolutism, and in 1688, they would be pivotal in deposing James II. So, the expanding trade opportunities presented by the Americas, the mass entry of English merchants into this trade and the economic development of the colonies, and the fortunes they made in the process, tipped the balance of power in the struggle between the monarchy and those opposed to absolutism. Perhaps most critically, the emergence and empowerment of diverse interests, ranging from the gentry, a class of commercial farmers that had emerged in the Tudor period, to different types of manufacturers, to Atlantic traders, meant that the coalition against Stuart absolutism was not only strong, but also broad. This coalition was strengthened even more by the formation of the Whig Party in the 1670s, which provided an organization to further its interests. Its empowerment was what underpinned pluralism following the Glorious Revolution. If all those fighting against the Stuarts had the same interests and the same background, the overthrow of the Stuart monarchy would have been much more likely to be a replay of the House of Lancaster versus the House of York, pitting one group against another narrow set of interests, and ultimately replacing and recreating the same or a different form of extractive institutions. A broad coalition meant that there would be greater demands for the creation of pluralist political institutions. Without some sort of pluralism, there would be a danger that one of the diverse interests would usurp power.